I know for some of you, just right then, you know, closing your eyes to pray was a difficult thing, but I will say this. If you have never prayed throughout the night, you're missing out. It's one of those things where every time I do it, you feel like you're walking in the presence of God different for at least the next 3 weeks. It's just different. So those of you that did pray throughout the night, well, I'm actually a little jealous, to be honest with you, because it's a nice feeling to be that close in the presence of God. Anyway, Gospel of Mark. We were talking about the authorship issues, date issues. Just summarize as briefly as you can what we talked about yesterday in particular. If it wasn't yesterday, I won't like slap you on the hand or anything like that. So, yesterday, what did we talk about? Yes?
We talked about the naming of Acts.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have to be in the early 50s.
Mm-hmm. 67 to 70, absolutely, yeah. How the dating of Acts and the dating of Mark, they're inextricably linked because of the Gospel of Luke. And as a result of that, if Acts is locked into 62, then we have to push Mark back earlier. Because more than likely Luke was a source. Or Luke used Mark as a source. But if we can dislodge the book of Acts from 62, which I think there are very good reasons to do, then it allows us not only the flexibility of the dating of the book of Acts and actually what was occurring with that book, but it even allows us some flexibility of understanding maybe what was happening at the time that Mark was written. This is something I don't think we talked about yesterday, but it's pretty important. It's the year of 69. In the Roman Empire, a very significant date. Why? Does anyone know?
Nero committed suicide.
Nero committed suicide in 68, but we're getting close. After Nero commits suicide, does anybody know who takes power? What's that?
Galba.
For how long? 7 months. He dies in 69, and then who comes to power? His name is Otho, and he reigns for like 3 months. And then a guy comes, his name is Vitellius, and he reigns for like a couple months. And then comes Vespasian. There are 4 emperors in the year of 69. 4. Why is that significant? Think from a Roman perspective, why is that significant? Yeah. Rome doesn't know if they're going to make it. They don't know. Because for the first time, since we're talking hundreds of years BC, there is war inside of the city of Rome. That was part of the Pax Romana, was that there were wars in Rome. It's just that they weren't in the city, or even where a lot of the noblemen lived. It was on the fringes of the empire. So the peace was more an internal peace than it was peace as a whole. Nevertheless, in 69, the entire empire was in flux. And you have 4 different emperors that are claiming the same title. Son of God. And we'll talk about that later. Talk about that later. But we also talked about not only the dating of Mark, which I do think it was in 67 to 70, which would have been around the time of this flux of the empire. But we also talked about how it was John Mark, which I believe we only summarized at the beginning of last class. I do want to read this, though, Eusebius quote, just to kind of pull together everything we had talked about as far as the authorship and the reason why it was written. Eusebius in Church History, Ecclesiastical History, 2.15 says this, "And so greatly did the splendor of piety illumine the minds of Peter's hearers." Notice who he's talking about. Who is it that's speaking here? Peter. The splendor of piety illumined the minds of Peter's hearers that they were not satisfied with hearing once only. What is that saying? After he preached, they're like, don't just give it to us one time. We're not satisfied with only hearing this once. We need to hear it more and more and more. "And we're not content with the unwritten teaching of the divine gospel, but with all sorts of entreaties they besought Mark." Notice what's happening? The people in Rome are begging for him to write it down. a follower of Peter. Mark, they besought Mark, a follower of Peter, and the one whose gospel is extant, that he would leave them a written monument of the doctrine which had been orally communicated to them. Nor did they cease until they had prevailed with the man, and had thus become the occasion of the written gospel which bears the name of Mark. What is he saying? What is he saying? The impetus, the creation of the book. What was the cause of it? The occasion. Yeah. Christians in Rome are saying, whoa, there's so much stuff going on here. And Peter's given this incredible word, but we don't even know how much longer Peter's going to be around. Nero's lopping off people left and right. He's imprisoning our leaders. Write it down. And Mark's like, I don't think we should write it down. Oral tradition has gotten us pretty good so far. Why would we need to write it down now? Please, as a monument of the doctrine of Peter, to remember him, please write it down. We can't just hear this once. And so he pens the Gospel of Mark in a time period where chaos would be a word that would be quite sufficient. My mentor, Dr. Robert Lowry, he passed away this past April, but he used to say this. He says that the opening of all the Gospels provides the key to understanding that Gospel. The opening. And that's one of the reasons why what we're doing is taking such a long time of building the lens through which we read the Gospel of Mark. Why would I do that? Why is the lens so important? It'll help you stay awake if you dialogue with me. Here we go.
Don't have the right lens, you don't read the right way.
Yeah. It's a very simple principle, especially for people that have glasses, right? You see things different when you don't have them on, don't you? Yes, sir. You see how that works? Same thing with the gospel. Same thing with any book that you interpret. What lens you're wearing affects the way you interpret it. Very simple. If you're looking for predicting the future and you go to the book of Revelation, that's what you'll find. But if you actually say, I wonder what lens the people in Revelation 2 and 3 were looking at this book as, that'll change your interpretation as well. What we're doing is building the lens with the author and the date, and now we're going to be looking at the opening verse. Because I believe, I've said this before and I said I'd prove it later, and now is later. I believe this opening verse is the most politically explosive opening verse of any book in the New Testament, probably in the Bible. But I'm a New Testament scholar, so we'll stay there. The most politically explosive. And you'll see that because of two different lenses. We're going to need to put on the lens, number one, of the Jewish kingdom. And then after we see it through that lens, then we will put on the lens of the Roman kingdom. And we will see the opening verse through that lens. So we're going to wash over the opening verse twice. Before we do that, let me read the opening verse. The beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Okay? Seems simple, somewhat benign. Normally, if we were not looking at any lens but the spiritual one, we're like, oh, that's quaint. Let's get on to the good stuff. Right? The beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And the Christians in Rome hearing that may have trembled. Because that's an explosive thing to say for several reasons. First of all, let's put on the Jewish lens. We need to understand, number one, the word Christ is a Jewish term. What does it mean? Messiah, which means Anointed One, which is another way of referring to a couple of offices in the Old Testament, three of which are most significant when it comes to Jesus. Do you remember? Kings, priests, and prophets. They were anointed ones. They weren't the Anointed One, although the king would have been. But the Messiah Christ is a Greek word that translates the Hebrew word, which is Messiah, which I think is best summed up in the English word King. So you're seeing how this is developing. What I want to do, though, is I want to take a couple steps back, and I want to ask the question, what does the Old Testament say or expect about a Messiah? Why? Why am I asking that question? What does the Old Testament think or say about the Messiah? What are they expecting? Why is that an important question to ask?
To determine whether he really is.
Say it again.
To determine whether he really is.
Yeah, number one, maybe we're just trying to... We got to figure out if he really is the Messiah. What else?
Figure out what the Jews were expecting.
We got to figure out what the Jews were expecting as a whole, don't we? It's one of the reasons why I'm having you guys read the War Scroll, which if you need to try to find that as soon as possible and read it as soon as possible. Because from what I'm hearing, it's proving to be somewhat difficult to find online, which surprises me because every other ancient document usually is pretty accessible. If you know where it is online, please let me know so that I can email it to me, the link, so that I can get it to everybody else. Because some people are having a hard time. Does that make sense? Okay, back to the lecture. The reason why I'm having you read that book, read the book from Qumran, is because it's coming from a Jewish perspective, albeit not a mainstream Jewish perspective, but a Jewish perspective nonetheless that reflects the perspective of the Messiah or the expectations of the Messiah that we even have in the Old Testament. Let me just kind of do a general overview of the expectations of the Messiah in the Old Testament. Those of you that are in my Christology class, you'll get a more fuller version of this in 2 weeks. So you can skip that day, I guess, if you want. Before the exile, in the monarchy, you know what I mean whenever I say the word monarchy, the kingdom, whenever the kingdom was established, First Samuel 8, I believe, is it? First Samuel 8. Whenever the people come to Samuel and they say, "We want a king like the other nations." And Samuel goes to God and he says, "Oh Lord, they've rejected my ministry." And what does God say? "No, actually they've rejected me." And you go back and tell them what a king will do to them. For he will oppress them. He will take their resources. He will enslave them to bring about his agenda. You tell them everything that a king will be. So Samuel goes back and tells them, and what do they say? "We still want a king like the other nations." And God says, "Fine, I'll give you a king." Which is interesting, because in 1 Samuel 8, it almost seems like that the establishment of the kingdom of Israel was more or less a judgment by God than it was a gift. Which is one of the reasons why I think that when Jesus came back, he wasn't going to establish a kingdom on earth in the way in which it was established under David. Why? Because that was birthed out of rebellion. Wasn't it? Anyway, that's neither here nor there. What's interesting is that during the time of the monarchy, we really don't have any overwhelming language or passages that are explicitly looking forward to the Messiah. Now, in retrospect, we do. We look back on passages like 2 Samuel 7, the promise to David, and we say, "See, there's the Messiah," and that's true. We look back on passages like Genesis 3, whenever it talks about, you know, the one whose heel will crush the head of the serpent, we say, "There's the Messiah." That's true, but those are retrospective understandings of the Messiah. You understand what I mean by the word retrospective? It's looking backwards. It's not at the time that they're writing it going, "And here is where the Messiah is." Because in the monarchy, they didn't really have much of a concept of the Messiah yet. The Messiah language explodes and really begins to develop in the time of the prophets, both right before the exile and during the exile. Why? Yes. There's something about oppression to the point in when you're desperate, wherever you try to even grab the language that can appropriately articulate the hope that you're desiring. And it's during the time whenever the kingdom of God is completely destroyed and Babylon and Assyria are having their way with God's people, wiping out the entire temple. At that time, you see an explosion of language describing the hope of the future, which is the Messiah. For example, Isaiah 11, 1 through 16. "That from the shoot coming up from the stump of Jesse." Jesse was whose father? David's. That's who this figure will come from. He'll be a Davidic king. Jeremiah 23:5, "The days are surely coming, says the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely and shall execute justice and righteousness in the land." What are they longing for? Liberation. Someone to come and rescue them. A messianic figure. The anointed one that will come and reestablish a kingdom. You see what they're looking for? I could keep reading. I could read to you Jeremiah 33, 17 through 32. "Nevertheless, with Jeremiah and Isaiah, the Jewish people were about to enter into a stage of deep oppression, which launched language referring to the Messiah. And with Ezekiel and Daniel, they are within that oppression. And therefore, once again, we see language of the Messiah." So you see where it starts to emerge. The messianic language starts to really develop in the time of oppression, the time of exile. Because what were they looking for? The Jewish people, whenever they went to exile, were looking for four things. Four things in particular. Were they looking for more? Sure, but let's just synthesize this down to at least four things. And each of the other things will fall into one of these four categories. Number one, what they were looking for the most. Well, I don't. The most, that's inaccurate. But one of the things they were really looking for was the return from exile. Man, the language just oozes throughout the prophets of the one day in which the people will be able to return to their land. Return from exile. They were pulled away by Babylon. Just read Daniel, first chapter. The temple was destroyed. Do you know what happened to the temple artifacts according to Daniel 1? The temple artifacts were taken into Babylon and used in pagan temples. Man, if that's not a kick in the face, I don't know what is. And so what they were longing for most was the return from exile. Not the most. That's not accurate. What they were longing for deeply was the return from exile. Also, and this is somewhat, and the reason why I can't use the word most is because all these are somewhat simultaneous. Number two, the reign of Yahweh at Zion. Return from exile would also put God back in His position of reigning in the temple. Isaiah 33:22 says, "For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king. It is He who will save us. He will once again reign." Number three, the Jewish people were longing for the exaltation of Israel once again. What does that mean? Unpack that with me. If they're longing for the exaltation of Israel once again, what comes with that? Maybe some sort of violence or military dominance. What else? That gets to the fourth one, actually, in just a minute. Yes, the subjugation of other nations. In other words, what Israel really wants to be is what Babylon is right now. That's what they want to be. They're more upset that they're not the ones in control than they are that they're the ones being punished. So one of the key things they're longing for is the day whenever Israel will once again be exalted to its position of dominance over the kingdoms of the world. And that leads to the fourth thing. The fourth thing they were looking for is the defeat of their enemies. And this is where the messianic picture throughout the Old Testament, in parts, but predominantly through the intertestamental period in the Jewish literature in there that you'll see in the War Scroll and things of that nature, really presents not just a Davidic Messiah, but a violent Davidic Messiah. Violence was very key and essential to the picture of the Jews and the Messiah. Because the Messiah was going to come to bring back the exiles. But the only way he could bring back the exiles, exalt the nation of Israel, and to have God once again reign in Jerusalem, is to wipe out the enemies that messed it all up to begin with. You see how that makes sense? The picture of the foot of the Messiah on the throat of the enemies was something that they not only longed for, but they were expecting to happen when he came. It may be one of the reasons why Jesus was such an anomaly to them. But we'll get to that throughout the class. The Psalms of Solomon, not Song of Solomon, Psalms of Solomon. This was a document written around the first century, middle of first century BC. Listen to the way it describes the Messiah. Psalms of Solomon 17, 21 through 26 and 32, although I dotted at times. It says, "See, Lord, and raise up for them their king, the son of David." Who would that be? Raise up for them whom? The Messiah. "Son of David, to rule over your servant Israel in the time known to you, O God. Undergird him with the strength to destroy the unrighteous rulers." What are they longing for? Violent liberation. "To destroy the unrighteous rulers, to purge Jerusalem from Gentiles who trample her to destruction, in wisdom and in righteousness, to drive out the sinners from the inheritance, to smash the arrogance of sinners like a potter's jar, to shatter all their substance with an iron rod, to destroy the unlawful nations with the word of his mouth. At his warning, the nations will flee from his presence, and he will condemn sinners by the thoughts of their hearts. He will gather a holy people whom he will lead in righteousness. There will be no unrighteousness among them in his days, for all shall be holy, and their king shall be the Lord Messiah. If that's not a lust for blood and violence, I don't know what is. But that's the picture of the Messiah that is going to bring back the people that are in exile. That's going to destroy the enemies. Destroy them like you will a potter's jar. To wipe them out. You almost get images of some of the Psalms, like babies being dashed against rocks. Qumran was the same way though. What you're going to be reading in the War Scroll will reinforce the same picture of this violent Messiah coming and not offering redemption for the sinners, but offering key judgment through fire and war and big time pain. This was somewhat solidified, this thinking, in the 2nd century B.C. What is significant in the Jewish history in the 2nd century B.C.?
Maccabees.
Yes, the Maccabean Revolt. And who are the Maccabees revolting against? The Greek Empire. The Seleucid Empire, to be more exact, because the Greek Empire after Alexander the Great was split into actually three parts, but only two of which were really somewhat dominant. The Ptolemies and the Seleucids. So what you have is the Seleucid Empire at this time was being ruled by the Antiochus Epiphanes, which is actually a word that somewhat means God manifest. I don't remember the pun. I know it's Antiochus Epimenes is what the Jews called him, but I can't remember the translation of what that word is. I want to say it's like something to do with a donkey. I'm not sure exactly though. Anyway, look that up for me if you want to. What happened during this time was this though. Whenever Antiochus Epiphanes was reigning, Jason, who happened to be the brother of a Zadokite priest, and if you wanted to be a priest, you had to be in the Zadokite lineage, but you also had to be chosen by God. Jason comes, and the way he gets to be the high priest was he bribes Antiochus Epiphanes to put him in the position. And what he then does, whenever Jason gets into power, what he starts doing, he starts Hellenizing all the key cities, even Jerusalem. One of the first things he does is he builds a gymnasium inside of Jerusalem so that there could be wrestling and different types of games. And what we started to find was instead of the holiness of the Jews saying this is not appropriate, because one of the things they would do is wrestle and they would be wrestling in the nude. One of the things that we found was the priests weren't objecting to it. They were joining in. Matter of fact, it even says that the priests were beginning to neglect the temple sanctuary and the sacrifices in order to take part in the gymnasium. But there was a problem. And without being too crass, the problem was that the Jews were easily recognizable whenever there's games, people wrestling when they're naked, because they're circumcised. And so what you actually have priests doing is doing surgeries to uncircumcise themselves, to erase the key identifying factor of their covenant with God in order to take part in the Hellenized games. That's a problem. That's called compromise or treason. Right? Eventually, it just gets even crazier after that. Menelaus ends up out bribing Jason at one point, and he gets the high priesthood. Everything starts to deteriorate to the point when a guy by the name of Mattathias was supposed to come up and offer a pagan sacrifice on one of the altars that was in worship of Yahweh. And he refuses. To the point where whenever the Greek guard, he was like, you do it or you're going to die. And he said, I'm not going to do it. So they push him out of the way, and another guy comes up to start to do the sacrifice. Mattathias, in his holy rage, lunges out and violently kills the man and then kills the guard, and him and his family and other people flee to the mountains. What does that sound like? Almost messianic, doesn't it? And then what you have throughout 1st and 2nd Maccabees, well, 1st Maccabees, 2nd Maccabees is kind of a zoom in on different parts of 1st Maccabees. But 1st Maccabees, what you have is a description of the miraculous victories of Mattathias and his sons. Sorry, sons. One of his sons was named Judas Maccabeus, which means the hammer, hence the name 1st Maccabees. Eventually, they had so many miraculous victories against the Greek army that it was one of the major reasons why the empire of the Greeks was weakened in that region and Rome was able to gain a foothold. Nevertheless, what the Jews did once they had finally eradicated the Greek empire from their region, they established what we call the Hasmonean dynasty. But there's a couple of problems with the Hasmonean dynasty. You would think that they're sitting there going, sweet, we've been released from exile because these messianic figures have come and set us free. Now the Hasmonean dynasty is reigning in Judea. No longer are we being ruled by the pagans. But here's a problem. Number one, the Hasmoneans ended up not only taking the kingship of Judea, but they also said the king will also be the priest. That hadn't happened before. But here's a problem with that. They were not from the lineage of the Zadokites. If you wanted to be the priest, you had to be in the lineage of the Zadokites. And they weren't in the lineage of David. If you want to be the king, you got to be connected to David. So what you have, the Hasmonean dynasty, is an illegal empire over Judea. Exile hasn't ended, even if they're under exile of their own people. You see what's happening? So what you have is, you don't have the messianic lust leave after the intertestamental period. It actually increases. Because what happens in the middle of the first century BC is Rome comes in and says, you're not going to rule yourself, we're going to rule you. And so Rome takes over. Herod the Great starts to take power around this time. Ever heard of him? Yes? Somebody? Good. It has to do with the birth narrative of Jesus, which we don't have in Mark, by the way. Hopefully you knew that already. I would have passed that on the test, Shane. Of course you did, because you've already read it. Where are we at? Oh, so when the Romans come in and take over, we have the Jewish Empire is back what? Back where they started. And so they begin to once again lust after and long for a Messiah, a violent Messiah to come about and wipe out the infidels. And that's why what you'll see in the war scroll is you'll see this name of a group called the Kittim. K-I-T-T-I-M. And scholars generally agree that that is a code name for the Roman Empire. But what's interesting is in the war scroll, the Kittim, they are the soldiers of Belial, which is another name for Satan. You see what's happening here? And what happens in the war scroll? Well, I'm going to ruin the ending, but you still have to read it. Is the Kittim are wiped out. Because the teacher of righteousness has come. And his army will overshine them because they are the sons of light and not the sons of darkness. You'll get that once you read it. But what does that tell you? That what you have in Qumran is a Jewish community that's still under exile that is longing for a violent liberation. And they call that person the Christ. You would think that it would somewhat wane. But what do we know about the 60s and 70s? What happens in 66 to 70? Talked about it yesterday. The Jewish revolt. And guess what emerged during those 4 or 5 years in the city of Jerusalem? Messianic figures. As a matter of fact, the handout I passed out to you, this list, this comes from Richard Horsley's book, Bandits, Prophets, and Messiahs. It lists all the different bandit slash messianic figures that occur in the first century up until 135 in the second century. Matter of fact, Jerome says that during the time of the destruction of the temple, inside the city, he says there were so many people claiming to be the Messiah that you couldn't tell who was a part of which group. And we can at least narrow it down to at least possibly three possibilities of the different messiahs. We really don't have time to get into that. Simon Bar-Giora would be one of them. Menahem, the son of Judas the Galilean, and also a guy by the name of John of Gischala. Although he doesn't have him listed here, he has him listed here as a bandit, but I would disagree with that based on the way in which he was treated afterwards. Regardless, the point was this, the messianic hope for a violent revolution even is what fueled the rebellion in 66 to 70. Because what they were thinking was this, if we start a war with the Kittim, although mainstream Judaism wouldn't have used that word, if we start a war with the infidels, God will raise up the one that will liberate us and bring the exiles back, exalt him in Zion, exalt the nation of Israel, and defeat the enemies. Let's kickstart this thing. After they're wiped out, the temple's destroyed in 70, the Jews were soundly defeated. You would think that they'd give up hope. But actually it fueled it more. The very last time, though, that we have a violent revolution led by a messianic figure comes in 132 to 135. Rabbi Akiva, a very influential rabbi, ended up designating a guy by the name of Simon ben Kasiba, as the messianic figure that would lead liberation for Israel. When he does, he actually renames Simon. He becomes Simon Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba means son of the star, and he named him after Numbers 24:17 through 19. And let me read that to you because this is interesting. He says, "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel." You see where he gets a messianic feel in this. Now notice what this messianic figure does. "It shall crush the borderlands of Moab and the territory of the Shethites. Edom will become a possession, Sarah a possession of its enemies, while Israel does valiantly. One out of Jacob shall rule and destroy the survivors of Ur." What is Rabbi Akiva looking for? And a Messiah. What's he looking for? Say it loudly, friends. What? Yeah. Messiah to come and wipe them out. That's what they want. That's what they've been tracing throughout the Old Testament. What they think they've been interpreting the Old Testament prophets. That's what exploded in the intertestamental period. That's what the Maccabeans somewhat looked like that people tried to mimic throughout the first century. That's what happened in 66 to 70, which maybe at the time of the writing of this book, by the way. And that's also what they eventually end up mimicking in 132 to 135. After that revolt, the whole belief in a future Messiah somewhat stopped in Judaism. They believe they must have been misinterpreting the messianic figure as a whole, and they say, because there isn't one. It's a metaphor. And so that's why today you won't have Jews looking for a Messiah much, because they don't believe that there is one. Otherwise, God would have already brought him. They change gears, which is quite convenient. So, the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. From a Jewish perspective, what would that word Christ be saying? This must be one of the violent liberators that we've been looking for. And written at the time of 66 or 67 to 70, the Gospel of Mark, people would have said, we know what he probably should be if he is the Christ. And yet what you're going to find is consistently, you have words of titles for the Messiah that Jesus says, that's the right word, but the wrong definition. Right word, wrong definition. Another word that would have stuck out for the Jews, we have 1 minute to go through it, awesome, would have been which word? You guess. It's in the first verse, you only have like 11 options, so it's not a bad choice. What word would have stuck out? Son of God would have, and we'll get to that in a minute. Gospel, not as much as for a Roman. Beginning. The way that the book of Genesis begins in Greek, the Septuagint, is in arche. And that's the exact same word that we have here. You could almost hear, in the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The Jew be going, yeah, that's right, because whenever the Messiah comes, there's supposed to be a new creation. Isn't there? Whenever the enemies are wiped out, Israel's exalted, God is reigning. There's no other concept to describe that as a brand new creation. They would refer to it as the golden age. What you have is you have him looking at them and saying, yeah, you're right, there is a new creation coming, but not the way that you're suggesting. Ooh, I want to get to euangelion, but not today. We'll pick up euangelion, good news, on Tuesday. What do you have due Tuesday? Does anybody remember? War scroll. Please, if you know where the war scroll is online, either come up and tell me, email me, do something so I can tell everybody. Okay? Do you know where it is?
Yeah, I'll email it.
Okay, awesome. So if you cannot find it, email me and I will send you the link. Sound good? You're dismissed. Love you guys.